Good afternoon. Welcome to Biz Talk, Believing is Seeing Talk Radio. I'm Bob Ryan.
I'm Montana Smith.
And I'm Aaron Cannata.
And you're going to be so happy you tuned in today. We have some stuff on this show today that you will probably not hear about anywhere else for a very long time. Chris Cooper is with us. He is an advocate for people trying to help others in the time of need, maybe elder care, invalid care, children, that kind of thing. He's a licensed fiduciary. And I know you've heard the word fiduciary kicked around a lot lately with the Department of Labor regulations kicking in and things like that. But he's actually licensed. He's authorized to be a fiduciary. I like being authorized to be a fiduciary by the state. And who knew you could do that, right? So he's officially the guy you want to talk to if you need help when things go wrong or you don't know who to talk to about taking care of mom and dad. Good guy. We're going to ask him a lot of questions about how to get things done that you want. He's also written a book called Elder Care Confidential. It is a good book. I want you to know about that when we talk. Before we get to Chris, though, Egbert Osberg is with us, drone aviator. He's actually coming on tomorrow, but we had an opportunity to snag him for a few minutes and like give you a little bit of insight about what's going to happen tomorrow, because if you haven't noticed, drones are a really big deal these days in all kinds of ways. Egbert, thanks for being here.
Glad to be here.
Now, you're going to be on tomorrow.
That's right.
So we don't want to give everybody everything right now, but what you do is so intriguing and so fascinating, and it's almost like the wild, wild west of aviation all over again, right?
It sure is. I mean, right now, the way drones are kind of taken off, pun intended, it's amazing.
I don't know why that's funny. That one shouldn't be funny, but it
works every time.
Yeah.
No, the drones right now are in its infancy, right? What we're doing, what things are going on. And what's really exciting, though, is that there's been a convergence of technology, of the public's appetite for this, and more importantly, the fact that there's just so easy now to not only get, but to fly.
So I'm going to ask you in a couple of minutes what got you interested in drones, but why does the average person, the average hobbyist buy a drone? What's the point? Are they doing something with it other than like flying a model plane or a radio-controlled boat? Is there more to it than that these days?
Right. I think that's probably what made the change. So what happens is initially it was a hobbyist. It was radio control, this part of the radio control type field. And what's happened is drones have come so far as technology is concerned, that they pretty much fly themselves. So where you have the racers, a drone racing league and such, where you actually have
I didn't
people,
know there was drone races.
There's a drone racing league on ESPN,
Whoa.
ESPN3.
Who knew?
Who knew? So it's
Uh-oh.
Actually, and those are quick. I mean, it's amazing the tournaments when you see them all around the world. In fact, we just had I believe 15-year-old out of the UK, there was a drone race in Dubai who took the purse.
Do they race them like the speed planes where they're on a bay and they have a track they have to follow and go through?
It's very similar to that.
Yep.
Actually, their track, though, for the most part, is they have to do a lot of maneuvers, right? So they have a smaller track than they do, say, NASCAR, but they have to do the very distinct maneuvers, and they have to do it quickly. So time is everything.
Are they racing, like, stock drones that they buy? Are they building these? Are they souping them up like this is the hot rod of...
That's exactly what they're doing. So these are the do-it-yourselfers, and they actually create their own drones, and it's all about weight and power and speed. So if it's not going to help them go faster, they want it off the...
What's the carts we raised our kids going downhill in? We built these carts for them and
Soapbox Derby.
Pinewood Derby. No, Pinewood's the little one. Soapbox is the ones that the kids ride in,
That's right?
Right. Boy, when we had our kids in those things, we did every little thing we could.
You want to shave off as much as
exactly.
you can. Every second count.
Exactly. Make them make a foothold in the bottom so they could pedal along.
Right, right.
Feeding's encouraged.
Right? Yeah.
Well, I don't know about that.
But whatever, anything to win.
Yeah. But back to your original question, the reason that I think right now the public so excited about the drones, it's in reality it's a camera, right? Right now it's being marketed as an aerial camera, and because it's a lot easier to maneuver, in fact there's a drone right now on the market this year which takes off from your hand, and basically it's a way to take a selfie, so and with hand gestures.
Talk about your selfie control, right?
Indeed.
I mean, pretty cool.
Indeed.
And did that revolution kind of occur because of the sports cameras now, the GoPro style cameras?
Well, the GoPro had a big part part in that, right? So the current manufacturer, DJI, which is, you know, big manufacturer out of China, they probably have a mass share of the market. And so they actually focus initially just on the platform itself to make it easier to fly.
I want to talk just briefly about DJI. There's some new rulings about them leaving a gap in the market.
Right. So you heard about that. Yes. The Department of Defense just issued a cease and desist letter basically stating that any operator within the agency is no longer able to use that platform.
And we're going to find out why tomorrow.
We'll find out more tomorrow.
Because we're not going to tell you today, because that's what's going to make you tune in, right?
That's correct.
What got you into drones?
Well, I'm a former naval officer. I actually got my surface warfare pin on board the USS Connie, the Constellation, here in San Diego. And so I was basically indoctrinated in that whole culture, naval aviation culture. And so when a friend of mine told me about, hey, look, this thing has been coming about 4 years ago, and it didn't take hard statistics to see how at some point this thing was really going to really mushroom when technology was able to come down to a point and a price point that it would be available to the regular person. And that's what kind of got me in the first place.
So you have a company that does work in the field of drones. Tell us a little bit about your company and what you're doing.
Sure. Our company's name is Drone Aviator. We're here based out of San Diego, and we are a technology company focused on providing consumer bundled products to the world. Right now, what we have is a technology that encrypts the data, and we're helping to identify drones in the airspace.
And to what end? Is it like the air traffic controller for drones kind of thing?
In a way. So what we're looking to do is we're going to be rolling out a new app here for the fourth quarter called Sky Club. And in essence, this app will allow you to download the app for free, obviously in the app stores, and then allow you to find cool places to fly your drone. So we're kind of crowdsourcing where to go find the best shots.
So it's
kind of
like a Waze for drones.
Exactly.
Everybody's reporting where there's... And does the software know when other drones are in the area?
Well, that's going to be in the next editions. But right now, what we want to do is make sure that when people actually get their drones, and this year they're talking about 2.8 million drones being sold just by one company.
In the United States?
Worldwide. But the majority of those are going to end up in the United States. Is we just want to make sure people, when they have their drones, they find the right places, the cool, safe places to fly. But importantly, I mean, they want to go out and have some fun. That's why they got the drone in the first place.
Well, you're seeing more of them at weddings and bar mitzvahs and other celebratory events, right? Just taking movies. You had one at your wedding, right?
I did have one at my wedding. We got a great film out of it, and it was a company that just was getting started with it, and they basically did it for free for us because they wanted to get their name out there. And
right.
So it was a really incredible thing for us.
Yep. The package that they download, the app that they download, they can get it from iTunes and Play Store?
Or yes. It's going to be Google and as well as in the iTunes App Store.
And that's free, right?
That'll be free.
So what will they get when they download this app? Do they already? I'm assuming the people that download it will probably already have a drone, or else they wouldn't.
Right. They either have a drone, or they just purchase a drone, or in most cases, most drone sales actually occur in the fourth quarter for the most part. And then, of course, just like when somebody gets a brand new iPhone 8 for this Christmas season, they download all these apps. So we would be one of those apps they would download to find a cool places to fly, and cool meaning safe places to fly.
Egbert Osberg, did I say that right?
You did.
Oh, yay. Egbert Osberg, Drone Aviators with us. We're talking about the app that your company has developed
right.
That can be downloaded on iPhones or Androids, and it allows people to manage in a more safe manner their drone flights and find good, safe places to fly.
Right.
Some of the rules that are in drones right now are fairly make sense rules. Like, you're not supposed to fly a drone where you can't physically see it.
Sure.
Isn't that kind of the number one thing you want to abide by?
Right.
Never let it out of your sight.
Absolutely. In fact, in the United States, the rules are fairly clear. So to be considered a recreational user or hobbyist, it has to be visual line of sight. So you actually have to be able to see it, number one. Number two, you have to fly under 400 feet. And then number three, daytime.
Can't do it at night.
Can't do it at night.
How do you know you're under 300 feet? Are there altimeters on there?
Well, on your ground control station, which is basically going to be your iPad or your phone or your smartphone device, it shows you that. The ground control station or how you control the drone will show you your elevation. It'll show you the camera, the video footage, all that kind of thing is right there.
So the flying at night makes sense because you would lose your sight of the drone. And I guess it's hard for the air traffic controllers that actually manage planes in and out. Can they see these things, the drones?
They cannot.
They cannot.
That's that's part of the big challenge. I'm sure you heard just about a week and a half ago in New Jersey, there was somebody flying their drone close to Newark.
No, and I didn't hear about that.
Yeah, so big deal, because in essence, they were about to make the airplane go to another, to Kennedy, but the pilots had visual line of sight on the drone itself, and they were able to land safely. But unfortunately, there's folks that either don't know or just don't care, and they're not supposed to be flying that high anyway, right? So that's part of the challenge.
What are some of the penalties that go along? if you are flying, I mean, because you could kill
we should
somebody,
let everybody
right?
know that, right?
Well, you know, what the biggest penalty right now is if you're flying near an airport or what's considered a no-fly zone, which is 5 mile radius, say, around an airport, 5 mile radius around a heliport, or
can't do it over the White House, I bet.
The entire city of Washington D.C. is a no-fly zone.
Is it really?
It is.
That would make sense, wouldn't it?
And I think that has something to do with that guy that flew his drone into the White House lawn.
Onto the White House lawn.
But no, so the fine is actually, believe it or not, up to $250,000 and 3 years in prison.
Oh, boy. That's not good. Yeah. And you could cause some pretty bad damage.
Well, that's really the thing, right? Yeah. Nobody wants to be that guy or that gal that, you know, something...
labeled for the rest of your life,
correct.
Right?
Yeah.
The rules on this, I'm imagining, are just in their infancy like the industry is.
Mm-hmm.
You have, at Drone Aviator, been selected, or maybe you personally, I don't know whether it was your company
the
company, have been selected to work on the rules the government's putting together. Tell us how that works.
Sure. So what happened was the FAA, as you know, they always come up with these committees. In this particular case, it's for remote identification and tracking of UAS. So a drone, the official term is an unmanned aerial system, or UAS, and those terms are used interchangeably. And so the FAA stood up a rulemaking committee. We're actually going back next week and at plenary session, and we're trying to identify the framework by which we can actually identify and track UASs or all drones in the national airspace.
Now, I have questions about what you're doing there, but just out of curiosity, how does that work when the government asks you to do something like this?
Mm-hmm.
Is it a contract that you have with them? Is it a revenue-producing item, or do you do it because it's your industry and you're volunteering the time? How does that all work
for
you?
It's all voluntary.
Is it?
It is all voluntary. They were able to select and vet companies, and they asked you to come because they wanted industry knowledge. And in particular, when it comes to recreational drone enthusiasts and hobbyists, we happen to be one of those companies that focus on that day one.
What got you into drones?
Well, number one, they're incredible.
I asked you that before.
Yeah, but the Navy first, but then I have four kids. And
yeah.
So my daughter, believe it or not, she's been flying drones now for about 3 years.
Really? Yeah. How old is she?
13.
I'm glad you didn't say three.
Right?
So, do you enjoy flying drones? I mean, is that fun for you
to
do?
It is fun. And if we think about it, it's really like the old times when my dad used to take me out. We used to fly kites because mm-hmm. I'm half Dutch.
Oh, that's a good point.
So
it is similar.
It's one of those things where you can actually do. It's you know, it's cool. You know, you're doing something with tech. You're getting into control. But you actually get some bonding time, too, instead of just sitting in front of the TV watching other people race.
Aside from cameras, are there any other attachments or devices or things that the hobbyists are looking at? I mean, are they putting, like, grabbing claws on the bottom to pick things up and move them yet? Or what's happening with any of those advances?
It's across the board, really.
Is it?
Because on a do-it-yourselfers, you get to kind of, it's like a Lego set. You can put whatever you want on it and make it do whatever you want it to do. But for the most part, the do-it-yourselfers are really just really focused on the racing part. Just, you know, get up there and
race. Oh, so racing. Okay, so racing and then the film camera
photography,
kind of thing.
Photography, that kind of thing. Yeah.
Have you seen any industrial uses of the hobbyist? In other words, are real estate agents using these to do virtual walkthroughs of houses?
Oh, yes.
What do you know in industry that's using them?
Well, what's happening is because of the capacity and the technology that these drones have is you can just take it out of the box and somebody can go ahead, say a real estate realtor would go take out a new listing, and the first thing they're going to do is have somebody go take pictures. Well, now not only are they taking pictures, they're taking a drone to go fly in the house and get some really cool footage, or fly up and do what's called a droney. So a droney,
what's
is
it called?
A droney is a selfie. So what happens is, so a droney, what happens is you have, you know how you say hello, everybody's kind of waving, and then you see it kind of zoom out.
Yes.
So they call that a droney.
Oh, that's a thing.
And
now,
that's the thing. It even got a keyword now. It's called a droney.
Well, wouldn't it be amazing if somebody from 200 years ago came forward today? They wouldn't understand 90% of what we say.
That's right.
It's a different, completely different world. Other than real estate, are restaurants using them at all? I guess what I'm saying is anybody that's got an entertainment venue
mm-hmm.
could use that as well for like the TVs and things like that on the side. Are you seeing any of that yet?
Well,
I'm looking for a market gap to make a business.
Well, you know, it's funny. A friend of mine client was at Black Hat, and he was using a drone inside to serve drinks. So, I mean, there is no limit to what the case will be.
Somebody would order a drink, right, and he would bring the drink to the table with the drone.
Right.
Okay, that's too cool.
I like that idea.
That's too cool.
Are there limits to, as far as the camera goes, how good of a zoom you might be able to have? Because I'm thinking, even if you're not in somebody's personal space as far as above their home,
right,
you might be worried about somebody peeking into your...
Sure. Privacy is a big concern, right? Yeah. Our company is always focused on three big pillars. The first one being safety. The second, security. And privacy, obviously, the third one. And the challenge is with so many different drones and the amount of drones that, you know, the public now is getting concerned.
Egbert Osberg, thank you so much. Drone Aviator, you're going to be on tomorrow. We're going to ask you a lot more questions. Up next, Chris Cooper, private fiduciary, trustee, conservator, and financial advisor. You're listening to BizTalk. I'm Bob Ryan.
I'm Montana Smith.
And I'm Aaron Tanata.
Don't you go anywhere, folks. We're going to be right back.
Welcome back. You're listening to BizTalk, Believing is Seeing Talk Radio. Want a podcast of the show? Of course you do. Go to www.espn1700.com and get yours. I'm Montana Smith.
I'm Aaron Cannata.
And I'm Bob Ryan. Glad to have you with us today. We're going to talk with Chris Cooper in just a minute, the private fiduciary. But our guest, if you heard before, the guy that just droned on and on and on.
Okay, crickets, Jeff.
I thought we were saving that for when he came back.
Well,
tomorrow.
I couldn't wait. I just couldn't wait.
We can reuse it.
Yeah, we can reuse it tomorrow. Anyhow, the point to that is, he did tell us a lot of things before the show that I'm so excited about finding out. For instance, the largest manufacturer to sell drones in the United States has now been banned from any military or Department of Defense work. And the reason why is mind-blowing. It's a Chinese company. You're going to want to hear why. Unbelievable. And the privacy issues around drones are just... there's a plethora of them. I always wanted to work that word into plethora. There's a plethora of reasons. Yes. So you will want to stay tuned. You could, but you'll want to tune in tomorrow at 2:00 to hear that. Chris Cooper's with us, private fiduciary, trustee, conservator, and financial advisor. Chris, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Great. I love your voice.
Ah, thank you.
You have a very manly voice.
Yeah.
First of all, I want to introduce the fact that you've written a book called Elder Care Confidential. Okay, that wasn't over the book. I just swallowed wrong. Elder Care Confidential. Tell us a little bit about the book you've written.
Well, the book was an idea to acquaint family members who are now thrust into the situation of having to take care of another family member. Could be their parent, could be their brother or sister, could be their own child. And what happens is they're not aware of their responsibilities and well as their own legal issues that can be reflected back on themselves.
I mean, our system isn't so sophisticated, everything's automatic yet?
No. My God. One of the biggest mistakes people make is, oh, we're married. I should be able to sign my husband's name to the tax return. No, you can't do that. You have to have a power of attorney to do that. Okay, that's a fiduciary duty.
Hmm.
All right. And so you get into those sort of arguments. And also then the other problem gets to be is just disagreements in families.
Wait a minute. Yeah. Before you go on, we'll talk about disagreements in just a second. Yeah. I was married for 30 years to a woman. I went by the bank once and tried to cash a check.
Yeah.
They wouldn't.
Yeah.
Because they didn't recognize my signature.
Yeah.
Because my wife had been signing stuff for so many years that's what they had on file.
Yes, that's true.
So
that's true.
I should have told her she needed a power of attorney.
Yeah, it would have been it's the correct way to do it.
She would have just laughed
anyway.
But
the problem is, see, people are trying to do things quickly and informally,
right. And
then they go into the bank and it's like, well, I'd like to be able to make sure my son or daughter could access my account. And then what do? They make them an owner on the account, and then son or daughter goes out and get in a car wreck. And that 100% of that account's available to pay creditors. So wrong approach. Don't use title. Don't take ownership. Use powers of attorney. However, problem is, we need to go to a lawyer to get one of those.
Mm.
And in some states, you know, you can actually print them off the web and have them notarized and sign them. The statutory power of attorneys are called. But in other states, no, you're required to have an attorney draw the document, or you run the risk of trying to do it on one of those legal Zooms or one of those things. And then you
end up not having the right thing.
Right. And then we're 50 separate countries.
Do the banks or the financial institutions, they never have their own paperwork if you wanted to put that in place?
No, and that's one of the other challenges is banks will oftentimes refuse your durable power of attorney if it doesn't speak to what you're using it for. For example, if it says doesn't say that you can make a withdrawal out of your dad's IRA account, you're not doing it. If it doesn't say you could surrender a life insurance policy, you're not doing it.
So the legal language is really important. You have to make sure you're writing these.
Absolutely. And a lot of times what I find is people don't even have a durable power of attorney. They'll have a basic will, but that's it. They got that done when their kids were born, and that's about all they've done in terms of estate planning. So one of the things I found when I became a financial advisor 30-plus years ago was people would come in for comprehensive financial planning, and it would be like, that's the biggest hole that was sitting there, is the estate planning. Nobody was doing it. Nobody was even looking
at it. And most people think when they have a living trust done, their estate plan is done.
Right. Or they think that, I went to the guy and I set my beneficiaries up on my life insurance and then my 401k and all that. That should be fine. Well, the problem is that's great if you're dead. What if you're disabled?
Yeah.
And unable to handle your own affairs? That's the hard part.
So you are a private fiduciary.
Yes.
You've been in the financial and advisory world, I'm guessing, most of your adult life, correct?
Yes, and in nursing as well.
Mm-hmm. So what led you down the road to be... Well, first of all, tell us what a private fiduciary or licensed fiduciary is in the state of California. And then if you would be kind enough to tell us kind of how you got there, because I don't think many people listening even know your licensure even exists in the state of California.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, it started back here in 2009 for the state of California. They put in a licensure law and created the California Fiduciary Bureau. It's a bureau of the Department of Corporations here in the state of California.
We needed one of those, didn't we? We needed
definitely. We were seeing situations. There was a story in 2005 in the Los Angeles Times about a fiduciary who was a conservator of adults in Los Angeles County, and she was ripping people off. Mm. Okay, and there was just no standards for it. You couldn't, you know, and how we used to become fiduciary or guardians or in some states, the other states we call them guardians. Here we call it conservatorship. It's a little difference in semantics. We're more conservative here. It's odd to say that in California. But yes, in our approach to guardianship, in other states, guardianship just takes away all your legal rights. You can't even vote or anything else. You know, here it would slowly take the parts away.
What, give us an example of how a guardian would step in, just real quick. What does that mean to people? Well, without getting you off track too much.
Well, what happens is a court called a probate court gets involved, and somebody has come forward to the probate court and saying this person can't take care of themselves or they're a danger to themselves or others. This could be a family member doing this, could be a neighbor, it could be a police officer, okay, it could be a doctor. Anybody can come forward and do that. The problem is, can somebody come forward and then be appointed as their fiduciary, their conservator, as we would say here,
to manage their affairs that they can't manage?
And our laws in all the 50 states still are geared at family members being this, sons or daughters. Now, the problem is, as we live all over the country now, my family lives all over the country. Nobody lives here in California with me, for example. Who would be my guardian or conservator if it was a family member? Well, there's no one available. So I would need a professional. So thus one of the reasons we have professional fiduciaries here is because so many people do not have family living present in the state.
Even if they have family, not always is that family either qualified or interested in doing it.
Right. Or they may have other difficulties and other challenges going on in their own lives.
Yeah.
So
the parent-child could be at odds or whatever. So the regulations and the licensure was formed in 2009 to allow somebody like you to become a licensed fiduciary, and you call it a private fiduciary.
Right. And we're private in this state. Why we're private is because we're paid from the funds of the person that we're conserving, or from trust if we're a trustee of a trust, or from the estate if we're the administrator or the executor of the estate. Okay. So we're private. In Illinois, for example, all the guardians are public. They're all paid for by the state. Okay. In other words, even if you're rich and you need to be a guardian appointed, the Guardian actually works for the state in Illinois. Here, no, we're private. We're all private. We have a public guardian for people who are indigent here, but we don't. But in other states, don't necessarily have that. You know, so that's what's tough. Please.
So, well, I think you answered my question. For people who are indigent, you mean, but if they didn't have anybody and they didn't have the means, they could be appointed somebody if they didn't.
That's right. Okay. That's right. We do have a public guardian here for that, a public conservator, as we say, and so it's kind of like the difference is we're throwing that fiduciary word around a lot in the financial planning world. And as I like to tease people, it's like, well, that's because the guy didn't sell you the investment that the guy that came to buy lunch that day was selling. Okay, you know, and it's like, well, that's kind of one example of it. So most people, when they think of fiduciary kind of duties, they think of a bank trust company. And a bank trust company has the powers, you know, in order to handle other people's affairs, but they can't make medical decisions for you. So they can't be your medical power of attorney. They can't sign your personal tax return. They can't make claims on insurance for you unless it's part of the trust. Okay, see, so it's a more limited role. And also, a lot of times in many states, and is also in many parts of even California, there's no local presence of a bank trust company. Hmm. They're not local at all. They're not even domiciled in the state that you're doing business with them in. Like Chase, for example, it's a New York bank.
So
right?
I'm guessing by what you said that as a licensed private fiduciary that you can do those things
yes.
for people.
Yes.
So I got so many questions to ask. Let's say that somebody is alone in the world and they have no kids and no heirs to speak of. If they die, that maybe nobody really cares about what happens to their assets. Maybe somebody does, but the reality of it is that might not be that important to them necessarily. But what if they're disabled and they're not able to make their own decisions? Is it possible for somebody to put in their trust document or their document that protects them in case something happens that you would be brought in on the case if that
yes.
happens?
Yes. Just as you do now when you go to your attorney to do your wills and trust and powers of attorney documents, you name who is the person that will succeed you in these roles.
I want to ask you how you get paid on that when we get back. You're listening to Biz Talk, Believing is Seeing Talk Radio. Private fiduciary, trustee, conservator, and financial advisor Chris Cooper is in. He's also written a book called Elder Care Confidential. I'm Bob Ryan.
I'm Montana Smith.
And I'm Aaron Cannata.
We got a lot more when we come back, folks. Don't go anywhere.
Welcome back. You're listening to Biz Talk, Believing is Seeing Talk Radio. I'd like to take a moment and thank our engineer, Jeff Bilodeau, music by Derek Audette, our wonderful interns, Sarah, Andrew, Leah, Deidre, and Chrissy, and of course, our director of marketing and PR, Katie Jensen. I'm Montana Smith.
I'm Aaron Cannata.
And I'm Bob Ryan.
And the voice of reason is back.
Took you a minute to get there, didn't it?
I had to roll my chair across the floor.
We had Ken Huebner come on because he actually has some really interesting questions, and he doesn't talk that much. So when he does, we want to get him on air. And we're with Chris Cooper talking about the things that you can do for people. And I asked you right before we went to break that if somebody could put you in their documents, that if they become disabled or can't handle their affairs, that you could step into that role for them. And
that's
you
right.
said yes.
Yes.
So my question is, how do they pay you to do that? In other words, if somebody's 65 years old and they have no heirs and they really don't have anybody else they want to use, or they do and they would rather hire you, but they don't need you today, do you charge them if they put you in the document, or do you get paid only when that's triggered?
I charge a retainer, a yearly retainer, but it's a small amount on a yearly basis just to be standing there ready to come in off the bench, you know, in the fourth quarter and throw the touchdown sort of thing, right? When I'm actually in the appointed role, like say I'm now the successor trustee of a trust, I can charge like a trust company does. I charge on a percentage of the assets. But when I'm appointed by a court to take over a trust.
That's regulated by the state.
Yes, that's yep. regulated by the state. But when I'm appointed by the court, this is what's interesting here in our courts here in California. San Diego and Los Angeles counties don't tend to want us to charge by an AUM or an asset under management approach, a percentage.
Really?
They want us to charge by the hour. So so we're charging by the hour.
Well, that would be kind of
unfair. Which is kind of like what I do expert witness work, or, you know, I have to come in and explain to the court, like, this person's not able to handle their affairs. Why? You know, what's the rationale there? And generally, you have psychologists to do this part, but it's like they'll let a gerontologist like me do it because I just deal with just the number things and the, you know, there's 9 criteria of competency to handle money. One is just to be able to count your currency, you know, your change. Right. The 9th one is, do you understand your investments and your insurance policies?
Yeah.
Well, I think we're all incompetent in that respect, even those in the business. Right? but nevertheless, that's how you do it. But the same way, your child, if it was appointed in this fiduciary capacity, is also entitled to receive compensation, and they should. They're going to be working a lot. Right. Sometimes they have to end up giving up a job or a promotion because they're dealing with all this stuff all the time.
It's similar to being a trustee, right? You can actually get paid for that.
Exactly. Executors now, or administrators of estates, no, we get paid when the estate is ended. So that's at the end, okay? And the same way with the attorney. He doesn't get paid to the end either. And then in power of attorney work, basically most of us just charge by the hour to do that. You know, so we're going to be there in the ER sometimes with the person, or we're going to have to, you know, be available to give consent for surgeries and things like this. You know, those are all going to be things we probably charge more by the hour for. But on the pretty much basis, we're handling assets a lot, but we're also handling people's lives. And it's the two together is why it's important. You have to be able to see them together. Sometimes you make decisions that are for the quality of the person's life that don't necessarily make good financial sense.
Chris, you mentioned that, like understanding statements or investments. And
yes.
And so far we've been talking a lot about somebody that has a diminished cash capacity or whatever. Okay. What if that person, the elder person, doesn't believe that they're diminished in capacity, and the kids are fighting, saying, you know what, this person shouldn't be handling their money anymore or other aspects of their life or making those decisions, but yet they don't want to give up that control?
Obvious to the individual, but it's obvious their kids.
It's obvious to everybody else. And unfortunately, that's one of the symptoms. Okay, of dementia setting in, and it could be dementia caused by depression, could be dementia caused by Alzheimer's disease or Lewy body's disease or other pathologies. But regardless of the cause, the situation's the same. They're handing money to every third vacuum cleaner salesman that comes to the door, or they're wiring money overseas to somebody that they've never met. Or in one case I was in Peru at the time, and his son calls me up on the phone and says, Dad is going to the bank withdrawing $2,000 in cash every day, and then he won't tell me what he's doing with it. And of course, what was he doing? He was giving it to the lady that lives next door to him.
$2,000 a day?
Wow.
Yeah.
I want to move in.
Yeah, I was going to say, do you have an address?
Yeah. One of my very earliest cases was a lady stole the box of checks. You know, when you order checks from the bank and they come in the mail, right? She took the box out of the lady's mailbox and took one of the books out. And then she just started writing checks to herself. And by the time we were involved with it, and how we got involved was this lady from an Episcopal church was coming to this house delivering communion, and she'd see the house is disheveled and the lady's, you know, using the trash can for a bathroom and things like this, right? And she's like, wow, you guys need to get involved in this. And it's like, yeah, but this has also got a government issues with called Adult Protective Services. Well, okay, we get the Adult Protective Services, we get in there, and it's like, well, yeah, we find $25,000 is missing.
Wow.
So we march over to the bank. Now, of course, this is past 30 days, so it doesn't matter if you're not on the signature card at the bank. Once it's past 30 days, it's ratified. It's as if you approved it.
Right.
Okay. Well, magically, they put the money back in the account. They didn't have to.
Well,
that was a nice bank, okay, but I'm just saying, you know.
So in those scenarios, typically, is it going to be a situation where it's the kids against the parent, or is there expert witnesses like yourself?
Yeah.
Would you come in and testify and say somebody in their right mind wouldn't be making these kinds of decisions?
Yeah. You would have people like myself. You'd have people like geriatricians, you know, medical doctors that are specialists in elderly people, neurologists, okay, which generally are consulted when people have dementia. And they would be brought in. You would have a hearing in a probate court. In a probate court is like a small room room. You don't have a jury, so the judge makes all the decisions, and you present testimony just like you would in any other court. And the experts would say, no, I mean, sorry, this gentleman's not doing right by himself. And unfortunately, at that point, they would take his adulthood away. We would call putting him under conservatorship here. In another state, we might call it guardianship. Okay. And you may have quite a lot of nastiness going on, unfortunately, the, you know, anger. Okay. But it is, unfortunately, in their best interest.
So if it's a small to mid-sized estate at that point, by the time you pay for attorneys and court costs and everything else, you've taken care of the problem by spending it all?
Sometimes. Yeah. That's, again, it's only if you get contested situations, you know, and rarely. You do see it sometimes, but not that often. Almost what I see here is I'll be in the courtroom, and I'll be sitting in the hallway at the court, and a lawyer will come over and say, I got a situation. Can I talk to you about it? And it's like, okay, tell me what it is. And it's like the lady will be sitting down the hall over here, you know, with her walker in front of her, and she needs to be conserved. And you go, what's wrong with her? Oh, she's having delusions, you know, and it's like, you know, things like that. And you go, okay, let me go see. And you go, okay, I'll take the case. Sometimes that's how you actually end up with the case in a court appointment situation. I tend to only do people that I know and I've worked with a long time. You know, that's just my style. And I tend to work only with elderly people. But now I'm seeing a lot of times where I'm having to deal with special needs children. Or people that were born with developmental disabilities.
I want to talk to you more about that in a second. Chris Cooper is with us, private fiduciary, trustee, conservator, and financial advisor. His book, Elder Care Confidential. We're talking about the ever-growing problem of our geriatric society, and not just ever-growing, but the population in general is growing rapidly, and we're seeing more and more cases where people are not able or don't want to or can't manage their own affairs, whether it's healthcare, whether it's their business affairs, their private investments, things like that. And that's what Chris Cooper does. He steps in as a private fiduciary, which is a relatively new license in the state of California compared to most of them, like real estate and securities.
Actually, no, in any state.
Is
we're
it
the
new
only
for
state
everybody?
That has, we're the only state that has license.
No
really.
Way.
Yeah.
I didn't know
other,
that.
Other states are still in the old registry model. You just sign your name on a list and say you're available, and then now they at least run a background check on you. You know, here, our licensure has double background checks, DOJ, FBI. I mean, it's much more intense, you know, than just to get like a securities license.
So right is there only a small pool of people who are fiduciary licensed here in California?
We have 900 actual licensees, but only 500 active licensees.
And you're one of the 500.
I'm one of the 500. Yeah, I'm 615 on the numbers, you know.
By the way, how can somebody get a hold of you? Because there might be somebody, I mean, we do have an upscale listening audience, that's
oh, yeah.
for sure. If somebody is interested in talking with you, how would they get a hold of you?
I have a toll-free number. It's in all 50 states because I serve clients in all states. It's 1-800-352-7674.
352-7674.
And I'm at chris@chriscooper.com or at my website, www.chriscooper.com. And that's also where you'll find my book. You can also download a chapter of the book. You can also get it in electronic form, the e-books, you know, from Nook or Amazon. Right now, we're in the production of an audio book for it. So it's,
are you going to use your voice?
No, unfortunately, it's unfortunately too time-consuming to do that. That's what that's one of the tough parts about it. But it was something I did want to do, yes.
Yeah. Maybe so, you could read like a forward to it.
It could happen. Yeah, it could happen.
The forward to your own
But right now, we wanted to at least get it out there because we being asked for it, you know, because people are, you know, the daughters are driving in their car. As a matter of fact, the lady that gave me an endorsement on the back of the book is she's out driving in her car every day in Chicago as a pharmaceutical salesman, you know, and it's like she listens to books on tape all the time, right? Mm. You know, and this was definitely one of the things she needed, you know, but I've had many people here in San Diego already asked me for this. So,
Chris, your background originally before you got into this, you were in nursing, correct?
That's right. I started to work in a nursing home. I went to work in a hospital as an orderly, and they put me in the emergency room. And that was in the 70s when the paramedic movement was moving. And Jack Webb had the TV mm-hmm. show Emergency, and I fell in love with being a paramedic. Well, I went out and did that for a little while. That was pretty physically hard work, I got to tell you. So I decided to go to college. And I went back to work in a hospital, and they put me through college. So that was a nice thing to do.
How much of your nursing background and your medical background plays into your role today in it. Well, we'll have to find out when we come back. I was going to ask you if it plays into your role today advising people about geriatric situations and things like developmental disorders and so forth. We'll get to that when we get back. You're listening to Biz Talk, Believing is Seeing Talk Radio. Chris Cooper's here. If you want to get a hold of him, it's 800-352-7674 in his book, Elder Care Confidential. I'm Bob Ryan.
I'm Montana Smith.
I'm Ken Huebner.
Boy, you're late on the draw with that.
I don't have drone speed.
We'll be right back, folks. Don't go anywhere.
Welcome back. You're listening to Biz Talk, Believing is Seeing Talk Radio. Tomorrow we have in studio with us Egbert Osberg, a drone aviator, and he is just full of facts and figures. You don't want to miss this. I'm Montana Smith.
I'm Aaron Cannata.
I'm Ken Huebner.
Well, I have to get you your own mic someday.
Well, I do that, you'd make me feel like important or permanent.
Everybody on Facebook Live, they're not even seeing that, are they? You should turn that around so you can see.
Hello.
If you're watching on Facebook Live, we've got two more headsets, actually, and Ken's responsible for fixing them. So as soon as you fix them, you can be a regular.
There we go. That would be cool.
We still only have four mic plugs.
Oh, that's true.
That's okay.
We gotta get a splitter. Get a splitter.
Yeah, I'm just worried about my feet getting rolled over here. And moving on.
Chris Cooper's with us.
I feel kind of like my grandson in his little walker, you know, when he's zooming around the house.
Elder Care Confidential is his book. His phone number, 800-352-7674. One of the things I would encourage you to do, And there's so many things in life that we're supposed to do. Eat right, exercise, get enough sleep, drink enough water. I mean, the list just goes on and on and on. Manage your investments. Make sure you get the right insurances in place. I could wear myself out just thinking about all the things we have to do. But I got to tell you, of all the things that you can mess up on, this is probably one that you really, really, really don't want to mess up on. If you have folks, grandparents, relatives that you don't know what's going to happen if they become disabled or develop dementia, you need to have some conversation with somebody about that. And Chris would be a good guy to talk to. What do you charge for, Chris, for your initial consultation?
I don't charge for initial consultation.
Okay, so
I have to know to meet the people and see them before I can quote a project fee on anything.
All right, so if you are interested, which I think you should be if you're not developed, and if you have anything at all, any concern at all about what's going to happen to your assets if you can no longer manage them. And if you think about, I want to ask Chris about this, but the thought of a married couple and one of them is disabled and the spouse cannot act for them, that could be problematic. So we want to get this taken care of. And we'll talk about that in just a second. Right before we went to break, Chris, I was asking you about your nursing career and how, if any way, that affects your ability and how you view things with maybe dementia patients or elder care, maybe developmental disabilities, et cetera.
Well, how I saw it was when I was a young pup out of nursing and went into the insurance industry, was doing insurance physicals, right? Hmm. It was an insurable risk, right? And one of the things I found was medical people took incomplete assessments. And social workers took incomplete assessments. And financial planners took incomplete assessments, if they took one at all. Hmm. Okay?
And they probably don't coordinate to make a complete assessment.
Exactly.
Do they?
Exactly. Yeah. So one of the things I did was to create a comprehensive assessment, which I kind of outline in the book, because you need to see it in all these six areas: medical, psychological, social, environmental, legal, and financial. And the reason why was because you go to the lawyer and he looks at the legal, but he doesn't understand the financial. You go to the doctor, he doesn't know anything about the social. He doesn't realize the neighbor next door is bringing donuts over to the diabetic. You know, as one doctor told me, he says, remember, when people come to see us, they're all dolled up with their Sunday go to meeting clothes on. We don't know that their house is full of floor to ceiling full of trash. you know, and you know they don't know what's going on. So I saw it as a need to be able to see more comprehensively, seeing the broad picture, which is the idea that financial planning was to begin with, right? Was to be comprehensive.
Right.
See the tax returns, see the wills and trusts, see the investments, see the risk management products.
But then a lot of it turned into insurance sales and
or
investment
it just turned
sales.
Into investment sales yeah. or asset management. You know, it, because again, we went to the simplest path. You know, people still do that today. They come in and it's like they want to talk about their money, and I'll go, well, that's good. Let's look at all that. Oh, you don't have a durable power of attorney.
Yeah.
Great. Oh, your wife's the beneficiary of your $1 million 401k plan. That's good. You're planning to be dead now, not become hit by the bus, but be in a coma. You see what the problem is.
And what happens there if a spouse in California, the most everything in California is considered community property, right? I mean,
yes.
So if a husband has $1 million in a 401k or a wife has one, either way, and that person's disabled, can their spouse that's not disabled now take over the management of that?
No, not without a power of attorney.
And I'm guessing most people don't have that.
No, because the reason why is when you go into your human resource officer or wherever at your work and do your 401k plan, your group life insurance, you put the beneficiaries down. Remember, when they come to make the claims on that, somebody gives them a piece of paper that says you're dead. It's called the state, the health department, right? The death certificate. We don't have a certificate that says you're disabled.
Maybe that's something people
and that's
look
the
into.
Problem. Very people. So then the bank would go, I don't know if you're disabled or not. So this is one of the problems we look at when we see durable powers of attorney. We see springing language in it, like, oh, this only comes into effect if two doctors say I'm disabled. Well, the bank looks at it and says, I don't know if you're disabled, so they won't accept the document. Okay. In other words, you're creating failure before it actually happens. And the problem with a durable power of attorney, unfortunately, it has to be in effect now, the day you sign it, right now. Meaning, if you give your daughter that power of attorney, she could go sign your name on an account and sell your car if you want to. She wants to. But you have to give them that power now.
Are spouses okay. the most common thing that you see that aren't prepared? Or what do you see in your world that just causes you to gasp and say, we've got to fix this? By the way, Chris Cooper is in. His phone number is 800-352-7674. His book is Elder Care Confidential. Pick up a copy. So, Chris, I was asking you about what you see that just really says, I'm in this for this reason. This is important to me, and I really would like to fix these kinds of things.
Well, the hardest one I see is children.
Ah.
Okay. And unfortunately, daughters are the disproportionately burdened with caregiving more than sons. But
because they're the good kids.
And unfortunately, daughters are also the number one abuser of the elder.
So they're not necessarily the good kids.
No, it can be from stress. The stress of doing this, dealing with the problem,
okay.
right? See, I'll give you an example. Mom says, take my credit card and go pick up the prescriptions at the Rite Aid. Okay, well, while you're there, you go, oh, I could use some underwear. Oh, I could use some potato chips. Oh, let's see. Oh, my son needs a hat to wear on the baseball field. What have you just done?
Yeah, and a lot
theft.
Of well,
yeah,
a lot of times
theft.
I bet, I bet okay. people aren't getting paid for this, even though maybe they should. So they feel they are rightly owed something.
Oh yeah,
right?
or like it's going to be mine anyway, and it's like they're just waiting for you to go ahead and die, will you please? You
or
know,
better
this kind
yet,
of mentality.
Mom wouldn't care, right?
Yeah,
mom wouldn't
yeah.
care.
She would
yeah.
want it this
yeah.
way, right?
Yeah, yeah, and it's like no. See, there's all this justification, and as the fraud examiners will tell you, you know, it's the crime of opportunity. All right, you know,
it's not that they set out to do it.
You got a whole specialty group within the CPAs are just fraud examiners that just deal with just this problem all along, okay? Again, another specialty doesn't see anything but one thing, right?
Yeah.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
That's what the problem is in the United States. We got too many specialists.
So when you're first okay? meeting with a family or say you're first meeting with an individual and they bring you and they have the foresight to say this could be a problem in the future, do you bring in their entire family or the people that might be involved? And then what goes into that? Are you taking a fact finder to find out what they've got? I just want to
yes.
understand a little bit about how the process starts and
yeah.
how you, okay.
Yeah. Usually it's a family member that's bringing this person to me. Okay. Usually they're not self-referring is
okay.
what I'm saying. I've seen that a few times though they've self-referred. But generally it's a family member and usually it's a daughter. Okay. And it may not be the daughter who is actually the strongest member of the family. She actually may be in the weakest position. She may actually be unemployed.
Which may be why she's asking for help.
And that's why they're burdening her with this. Well, you don't have a job, so here, you go do this. And it's like you don't have anything else better to be doing with your time, right? Okay. And so then I'll start taking down information, and I'm looking at it in my six areas like that. And I'll say, well, okay, now tell me about your medical history and all this. And it's like, uh-huh. And then I got to look at the numbers, right? And see, this is kind of like when a home... When you have a Medicare social work visit comes out, the social worker will go through things and say, well, let me see what public assistance programs we have available. Can you tell me how much money you have in the bank? And they'll go, I'm not going to do that. You know, they're not going to tell you. Right. Okay. In other words, they'd rather strip naked for the doctor than show you the checkbook. Right. Well, being a financial person, they'll show me the checkbook. Because I'm a financial person. Right. See, you see how that's a little
easier.
You're like
the doctor of checkbooks.
Okay.
Right.
So sometimes what you're doing is basically you're playing the third party as a mediator between the family, trying to see if you can get the information out of mom and dad to see if they're okay. And also seeing what their resources are so you can figure out what path they should or should not go down. Like, no, you can't afford to go to the $10,000 a month assisted living place in La Jolla, okay? Or yes, you can, but that doesn't mean you should be there.
Chris, I want to go back to the kids for a second. We didn't kind of wrap up on that. You said the kids are the hardest thing that you see.
Oh, yeah.
How do kids, are you talking about kids that need your services as their guardian and fiduciary, or the parents need your services because of something with the kids? I'm not quite sure.
Both. It's both. The kids will come in and personally not know anything about their parent. They'll not know where their parent does their banking at.
You're talking about adult children, right?
Yeah, adult children. Okay. They'll be 50 years old or so, plus or minus 20 years, and they'll come in and they'll know anything about their parent. They don't know where their parent, banks, who their financial advisors are, if there is any. They don't know if they're.
But their insurance is maybe?
They might know their home is paid off or something because they remember the celebration, burning the mortgage and all that kind of stuff. But you see what I'm saying? They don't know a lot about the parent. And there's also things they don't know about the parent that just makes the parent an adult. They don't know their little quirks or their little kinks. And so all of a sudden, now the children are learning about their parent as an adult. And now their parent has to see the child as an adult.
Yeah, and that's difficult.
Not as you're still my little girl, my little boy, you know, that kind of thing.
We're kind of running out of time, and I want to make sure I get this in. So if somebody has a child with special needs and cannot manage them effectively, if they're disabled, the parent's disabled.
Yes.
Can you step in as the fiduciary for that child if the parent can no longer do it or the parent passes away?
Yes. I can take guardianship of a minor child or conservatorship of an adult, okay? But that doesn't mean I'm going to be their parent. I'm not going to raise them. They're not going to live in my house.
You don't have 22 kids there.
Yeah. In other words, that's what the part that people don't quite understand the idea of a guardian is that the guardian isn't necessarily the person that's going to physically take care of
Chris Cooper, thank you so much. 800-352-7674. His book, Elder Care Confidential. Hopefully you can come back again. We have a lot more questions for you. You're listening to Biz Talk, Believing is Seeing Talk Radio. I'm Bob Ryan.
I'm Montana Smith.
I'm Ken Huebner.
And I'm Aaron Cannata.
Talk to you tomorrow, folks. 2:00 right here.